You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. On Thursday night, the 14th of October 2010, Natalie Villerme was about to head home after a long day at work. She owned and managed a hotel restaurant on the outskirts of Paris. The Clos des Roses was her pride and joy, and it was a well-oiled machine. She called home just after 8 p.m. to tell her partner, Mark Desterbeck, that she was about to cash up and that she would see him soon. She usually called before she left, so Mark would know that she was on her way. But Natalie never made it home that night. As the hours rolled past, Mark was confused. And the later it got, he became increasingly concerned. At first, Mark thought he'd misunderstood her. Natalie had many friends and loved socializing. He turned over every word of their conversation. Perhaps she meant she was leaving work soon to go out with friends. Mark called the restaurant, but Natalie's staff told him she wasn't there and that she left soon after calling him, about 8:30. After looking for her the whole night, Mark went to the gendarmerie at Versailles to report Natalie missing. He provided a detailed description of Natalie and her vehicle, as he could not find either. What neither Mark nor police knew was that Natalie would never come home again. Within hours of Mark reporting her missing, her body was discovered in Marly Forest on the outskirts of Paris. She had been brutally murdered and buried in a shallow grave. It was incomprehensible that anyone would want to harm the vibrantly friendly hotelier of Mesnil-Loire. Natalie's small hotel only had 10 rooms. On the night of her murder, they were all booked out. From the start, police believed the killer was one of the guests at Clos des Roses. The case unfolded like a game of Clue, with all too many suspects and no answers. Natalie Villerme was a friendly, kind-hearted person who loved spending her time surrounded by other people. Everyone knew her by her sparkling smile, and she had many friends. She lived with Mark Desterbeck, her partner of 25 years and father of their two grown sons. By all accounts, Natalie and Mark had a loving relationship. Natalie met Mark when she was in her early 20s. They worked together at a restaurant where Mark was a barman and Natalie a waitress. Mark was immediately drawn to the beautiful, energetic Natalie with her intense blue eyes. After dating for 2 years, in 1988, Natalie gave birth to their first son. 2 years later, the youngest completed their family of four. Theirs was always a happy home, a place where their friends were always welcomed with open arms. In 2005, Natalie bought a small hotel restaurant in Le Mesnil-Loire called Clos des Roses. It was a dream come true. Having worked most of her life as a waitress, she finally owned her own place. Natalie, who ran the business with Mark and their son Anthony, was determined to make it a welcoming place for guests. The family owned and managed Clos des Roses soon became the heart and soul of Le Mesnil-Loire. Mainly a residential area, Le Mesnil-Loire is situated on the left bank of the River Seine on the outskirts northwest of Paris. With the river on one side and the forest of Saint-Germain-en-Laye on the other, this hamlet is rarely visited by tourists, and locals prefer it that way. The Clos des Roses was pretty much the only restaurant and bar in the area. It also served as a tabac, a place where people went to buy cigarettes, newspapers, bus passes, postage stamps, and lottery tickets. Most customers stayed for a quick drink or a bite to eat whenever they came around. Natalie had a way with people. She had a friendly but firm hand with customers who had had enough to drink, without causing a scene. Regulars respected Natalie and always felt welcome at the Clos des Roses. She knew how to create a warm atmosphere, and spending most of her time there, it didn't feel like work to her. When she was there, she was in her element, happy. The hotel part of the business wasn't luxurious, nor did it attract many tourists. It became more of a boarding house, a place of refuge for people who had fallen onto hard times. Some of the longer-term residents were referred there by social services. It was a constant source of income for Natalie and Mark, and they never showed anyone away. Thursday night, the 14th of October, was like any other night behind the bar at Claude Rose. Natalie served drinks and talked to customers, and by 8 o'clock she was ready to call it a day. She called Mark and said she would finish cashing up for the day and leave. But she never made it home. After looking for her everywhere, calling everyone he could think of, Mark reported Natalie missing at 7 a.m. When a report came into the Gendarmerie of Versailles around midday of a body found in the woods near Somnambule-Bretèche, it didn't take officers long to connect the dots. On Friday morning, a group of mushroom foragers came upon a grisly scene. One of the men saw a pair of ladies' boots, partially covered with twigs and foliage. On closer inspection, he realized it was a dead body. Police were called to the scene where they determined that the body fitted the description of a missing person, 46-year-old Natalie Villerme. When she was found, Natalie was lying face down in a ditch, her hands tied behind her back with her own belt. Her body was covered with branches and leaves in a clumsy attempt to conceal her. She had severe head injuries, and her face was unrecognizable. She had no form of identification on her, but it didn't take police long to link the discovery to Mark's missing persons report. Forensic experts set out to examine the scene in the forest. A wide area was cordoned off as the search for evidence began. If Natalie had been attacked at the scene, there would have been a lot of blood. But investigators only found small traces around her body. The scene was a dumping site, not the murder site. Natalie's white Renault Kangoo van was nowhere to be found, and all law enforcement agencies in the area were notified to look for it. A row of gendarmes spread out to fine-comb the direct area around the body. Immediately, they found a fresh tire print and some footprints made by a man's shoe. Within 50 meters from the body, they found what was likely to be the murder weapon, a sturdy tree branch, about 90 centimeters long, covered in blood. Further testing confirmed that the blood was indeed Natalie's. It was peculiar that the piece of wood had been shaped, sharpened at both ends. It wasn't a weapon of opportunity, but a weapon that had been fashioned to inflict serious harm. It became clear that the murder took some planning. The post-mortem examination determined that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. Natalie's pants were undone and her bra unfastened. Although she had not been sexually assaulted, the medical examiner concluded that there was sexual motivation behind the murder. Her belt was removed from her waist and used to tie her hands behind her back. On the belt was Natalie's DNA, as well as a sample of the DNA from an unknown male. Police knew that Natalie was murdered sometime after leaving work at 8:30 p.m. and before 11:30 a.m. the following day when her body was discovered in Marley Forest. Investigators interviewed everyone in Natalie's life, her partner Mark, their sons, regular customers at the Claude Rose, as well as all guests staying at the hotel on the night of the murder. All male patrons were asked to provide a DNA sample to test against the profile found on Natalie's belt. A staff member from the bar at Claude Rose confirmed that when Natalie left at 8:30 p.m., she had the day's money with her, an amount of about 200 euros. Natalie made no secret of the fact that she was taking the money. Anyone could have overheard her. There was no money found at the crime scene, so police wondered if the motive was theft. The guest who stayed in room number 5, Veronique, told police that she was friends with Natalie. She said that she was in her room at 8:30 and saw Natalie leave from her window. But Natalie was not alone. One of the other hotel guests was with her, the occupant of room number 6, 46-year-old divorced father of two, Patrice Chevalier. According to Patrice, on Thursday night, Natalie had agreed to give him a lift to his girlfriend's place in Poissy, 15 minutes away. At the time, he had been staying at her hotel for 2 years, and they knew each other well. Patrice's girlfriend, Elise, confirmed that he was with her all night and only left around 5 a.m. the following morning. That next morning, Patrice heard that Natalie had not made it home the night before and helped Mark and their sons in the search for her. When investigators asked Mark about Patrice, he was surprised. Mark didn't suspect Patrice had anything to do with Natalie's murder whatsoever. He knew him well and trusted him. Patrice often walked Natalie to the van, and she occasionally gave him a lift somewhere. Nothing about the situation gave Mark any reason to doubt Patrice's story. Police had to concede that Patrice Chevalier was probably not Natalie's killer. They continued questioning other guests at the hotel. The man in room 9, Fabrice, was known to have a violent temper, and he had recently fallen out with Natalie. She accused him of taking money from the till in the bar, something he had denied. Natalie confided in Mark that Fabrice had an aggressive streak and she was scared of him. Police were immediately suspicious of the man, mainly because the money Natalie had on her was missing, and took him in for questioning. They wondered if he had stolen money again, and that Natalie's death was a result of a confrontation. Fabrice denied any involvement in her murder. He also emphatically denied ever taking money from Natalie in the first place. Fabrice claimed he was alone in his hotel room the entire Thursday evening, and that he had made several phone calls. Investigators were able to confirm that by following up on the phone records made from Fabrice's room that night, there was enough evidence to convince police that he was not the killer either. Then results came back from the post-mortem examination. Investigators were surprised to learn that the male DNA found on Natalie's belt belonged to her tenant and employee, Patrice Chevalier, from room number 6. He was re-interviewed and asked how his DNA could be on her. Patrice did not seem concerned in the least. He thought for a moment, then recalled that he was working with Natalie on that day, painting a room at the hotel. According to Patrice, while Natalie was on a ladder, she felt dizzy and lost her balance. He stopped her from falling by grabbing hold of her hips. Patrice recalled that he had touched her belt while holding her, steadying her. The story didn't stop there. Patrice made a shocking revelation, saying that at that moment, when she had quite literally fallen into his arms, they kissed. It wasn't the first time, as they had been having an affair for a couple of weeks by then. In fact, they had been intimate on that same afternoon in one of the rooms at the hotel. A hotel staff member confirmed that Natalie and Patrice painted a room that day, but could not imagine them having an affair. Patrice told police that Natalie's relationship with Mark was not as happy as it seemed from the outside, and that it was Natalie who had initiated the affair with Patrice. In his police statement, he said, "She would joke and tell me she wasn't wearing any underwear. I liked her, but I wouldn't hit on her in principle." Police were skeptical about Patrice's claim of an affair. They decided to ask Mark, who was extremely distraught over Natalie's death, about the state of his relationship with her. Mark said that they were happy and got on just fine. Mark also said that he and Natalie were talking about finally tying the knot, after being together for almost 25 years. They never had any problems, and were extremely fond of each other. But police couldn't only take him at his word and decided to tap his phone. Before long, they obtained evidence that Mark was having an affair with a woman named Claudine. A month after Natalie's murder, one of Mark's phone conversations with Claudine stood out to investigators. Claudine wanted to know where Mark wished to meet, and he said that she should come over to his place, as he had been traveling to Versailles for 19 years to see her. It was about time she made some effort to come to him. To investigators, it seemed like Patrice Chevalier was not lying after all. But they had to hear what Mark had to say about his clandestine personal life. They took him in for questioning and played the recording of his phone conversation to Claudine back to him. Mark insisted that they were only friends. She was a former employer of his, and they had kept close contact over the years. Natalie knew Claudine well, and they were both, as a couple, close to her. Claudine also denied the affair and echoed Mark's description of their relationship. With no further evidence of an affair or any indication that Mark had anything to gain by Natalie's death, he was ruled out as a suspect. Police concluded that his relationship with Claudine was a close friendship and nothing more. The investigation was back to square one. That is, until the results of forensic tests on the murder weapon came back. On the wooden stick soaked with Natalie's blood was the DNA of the last person who saw her alive, Patrice Chevalier. Again, Patrice had a story. He said that when Natalie gave him a lift, they had car trouble. Natalie stopped and he got out to see what was going on. That's when Patrice found a twig stuck in one of the wheels and struggled to remove it. He looked around and found the bigger stick to flick it out. He said he left the stick in the car. Perhaps the killer found it and used it to attack Natalie. Investigators didn't buy Patrice's story and realized they needed to find a way to disprove it. Firstly, the stick had been sharpened at both ends. It was not a stick one would pick up next to the road. The stick was sent in for further analysis to determine if the type of wood was local to the area where Patrice said he had picked it up from. Testing showed that the stick came from a goat willow. Experts searched the surrounding area where Patrice claimed they got stuck and could not find a goat willow anywhere nearby. The chances of him picking up the stick next to the road were slim. Investigators looked at cell phone tower evidence to establish Patrice's movements on the night. He said he was at his girlfriend's place in Poissy all night and left at 5 a.m. Friday morning. However, evidence showed that between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., his phone pinged at Moranvilliers, which is a 15-minute drive west from Poissy. Then his phone went off the radar, only to reappear at 4:46 a.m. at Sous-Nom-le-Bretèche, south of Poissy, close to Marly Forest, where Natalie's body was found. Police questioned Patrice's girlfriend Elise again, asking about his whereabouts that night. Elise stuck to her original story that Patrice was with her the entire evening. However, once she understood the implication of covering for him, she admitted that he was never there. She told investigators that Patrice had asked her to lie. Elise said, "I wanted to protect Patrice. He told me that he was going to do something with friends. In case of trouble, he asked me to say that he was with me all night and that he left the next morning. It was like a favor I did for him. I never thought he could do anything bad." To make things worse, Elise said that Patrice had asked her to cover for him on Thursday afternoon before the murder. Natalie's murder was no accident or rebuffed advance that turned deadly. He had planned it. He had fashioned a murder weapon and secured an alibi. But after Elise came clean, it all came crashing down. After squashing his alibi, police arrested Patrice Chevalier. Again, he had a story, explaining why he had asked Elise to lie for him. He said that he partook in a robbery with four other men. They went to Honfleur to settle a debt, so to speak. He was driving the getaway car and didn't want to name his accomplices as a code of honor among thieves. Police called him out. Admitting to committing a robbery would be less serious than being accused of murder. Surely, if the robbery was his alibi, he would give them more details, but he refused. Patrice was full of it, and investigators knew it. The robbery story didn't make any logical sense. Honfleur is on the coast of Normandy, about a two-hour drive from Sous-Nom-le-Bretèche. His cell phone movements indicated that he was in the outskirts of Paris all night. Police secured a search warrant and paid a visit to room number 6 at the Clos de Rose. They conducted a thorough search of Patrice Chevalier's belongings and found a pair of jeans stained with Natalie's blood. Patrice was ready with an explanation. He said that Natalie had had a nosebleed once he helped her load the van. Forensic examiners tested it again. The blood was not consistent from blood one would expect to find from a nosebleed. In Patrice Chevalier's room, there was even more damning evidence. Police found 5 different cell phones with more than 50 photos of Natalie. All of the pictures had been erased shortly before the search, but police were able to retrieve them. The images were all stolen photos of Natalie's thighs, legs, and breasts. None had her face in the frame. It was evident that it was taken under a table or behind her back. She was clearly unaware that the photos were being taken. Confronted with the evidence, Patrice shrugged it off, saying that many men take pictures like that. He admitted, however, that, quote, "her body did something to him," end quote. A friend of Natalie's told investigators that in the time leading up to her murder, Patrice became relentless in his romantic pursuit of Natalie. She was not interested and was planning on asking him to leave the hotel at the end of the year. Natalie had had enough, but because she was kind, she did not want to kick him out before Christmas. She felt sorry for him. Patrice most likely knew he was about to lose his job and his home and wanted to try one last time to seduce Natalie. If she refused, he would end things his way. As evidence was stacking up against Patrice Chevalier, investigators looked into his background. Patrice was born in Poissy, not far from the Mesnil-Loire. His father was an electrician, and his mother worked in a laundry. As a baby, he was left with his grandmother in Normandy and only joined his parents in the Paris suburbs when he was 6 years old. Patrice stayed with his parents for about 5 years before he was sent to a boarding school that assists at-risk youths from lower-income families by providing training in various trades. He trained as a miller, but never completed the course. When he dropped out, the school helped him to get a job at a printing press. After a year and a half, he was made redundant. Out of options, Patrice applied to join the army, where he worked as a delivery driver. After the military, he never quite settled into any one job, working in sales and even had a short stint as a realtor. In France, one's accent says a lot about your social background. Patrice spoke in a titi Parisian accent, an almost extinct 1920s street kid twang. The best example would be the character Gavroche in Les Miserables. Because of the way Patrice spoke, people didn't really take him seriously. He was like a caricature of a Parisian thug. In 1990, Patrice was in a devastating car accident. He was in a coma for 6 months, and after a long road of rehabilitation, he was ready to work, but could only find odd jobs. He was never quite the same after the accident. Before, he used to be athletic and agile, but afterwards, he could not quite keep up with his usual pace. Despite his setbacks, he carried on with life the best he could. He got married and divorced, and married and divorced again. The failed marriages gave him 2 sons, whom he adored. In 2007, Patrice lost his driver's license because of a DUI incident and lost his job as a driver. In 2008, this downtrodden man moved into the Clos des Roses. Nathalie Villermay took pity on him and offered him a job at the hotel. He did odd jobs from maintenance to helping out in the restaurant. Sometimes he helped with deliveries, even though he did not have a valid driver's license at the time. Because the Clos des Roses was a family business, all the employees and long-term tenants became a part of Mark and Natalie's extended family. This quote is from Patrice's first statement to police. "I consider Nathalie to be a friend. She means a lot to me. She is a person I'd give my life for. It was not me who killed her." He also told investigators about his accident and how he had lost everything. His family, his job, his home. He had to learn to walk and talk again, and he was finally living independently again. He was proud of his progress and said that he had Nathalie to thank. She was the one who had offered him a job and a place to stay. Why would he harm her? And why would he risk losing everything if he had only just begun to live his life again? By this time, police did not believe a word Patrice Chevalier said and spoke to people who knew him well. His ex-girlfriends all came back with stories about Patrice, saying he was a liar and a manipulator who could be violent at times. His ex-wife Sandrine said he used to calculate how many times a week they had sex. He kept a timetable, carefully logging their entire sexual history. According to Sandrine, he had an insatiable sexual appetite. 3 weeks after Nathalie's murder, Sandrine came forward with a chilling story. She claimed that on the night of the 14th of October, she received a phone call from Patrice at 9 p.m. She thought it was odd, seeing as they had not been in regular contact. They had a short conversation earlier in the afternoon. Why would he call again? When she answered, she realized that he must have pocket dialed her because all she could hear was background noise. Then she heard a woman screaming. At the time, she didn't think much of it. Perhaps he was at a fairground or something, so she left it at that. But when Sandrine learned about Nathalie's murder, and the fact that Patrice was the last person seen with her, she thought it could have been Nathalie's final screams as he was killing her. He called at 9 p.m., 30 minutes after they left Le Mesnil-Loire. Did Sandrine inadvertently witness Nathalie's murder? Police realized that Patrice would keep on talking his way out of the murder unless they had irrefutable evidence. Eventually, they found her Renault Kangoo, a fair distance away from where her body was found. After examining the vehicle, forensic investigators reported that they found traces of Nathalie's blood on the hood. Blood splatter evidence proved that she was struck while she was standing in front of her van. In the back were blood drops from a person who was already deceased. Fibers on the driver's seat matched fibers from Patrice's jacket that was found in his room. The same jacket with Natalie's blood on it. However, the tire tracks didn't match the tracks found at the scene in Marley Forest. Patrice refused to confess to the murder. He maintained that he had a strong connection to Natalie and insisted that they were romantically involved. Everyone who knew Natalie was adamant that she would never have had an affair with Patrice. Hotel employees corroborated her friend's story that she was aware of his affection for her and had wanted to terminate his lease to put an end to the situation. The first thing Patrice did when he was in prison was to write a letter to Natalie's partner. "Mark, I give my deepest condolences to you and your children. My whole heart goes out to you. I have nothing to do with this horror. I think you know I was very fond of Natalie, and I would never cause her any harm. I am thinking of you and hope that you're holding up okay. Patrice." Mark finally came face to face with the man he once trusted. Patrice Chevalier's trial started on the 25th of November, 2013, and lasted for 5 days. The prosecution reconstructed the sequence of events, as confirmed by evidence collected during the 2-year investigation. On the evening of the 14th of October, 2010, Natalie Villarme was finishing up at the bar of the Clos de Rose and called Mark to say she'll head home as soon as she'd cashed up for the day. As she was ready to leave, Patrice asked her for a lift to Poissy. Because he had been coming on to her, she was tentative, but when he told her he was going to his girlfriend's place, Natalie was quietly relieved and agreed to drop him off. Veronique saw the two of them walking to the van with Natalie getting into the driver's seat. As they were driving along, somewhere on the way to Poissy, Patrice then propositioned Natalie, who didn't want to have anything to do with him. She most likely pulled over to let him out of the car, and when he refused to get out, she jumped out to get away from him. Patrice, prepared with his wooden stick, caught up with her in front of the car and threatened her. When Natalie still wouldn't give in, he started hitting her over the head, again and again, until she dropped to the ground, unconscious. Blood splatter on the hood of her car proved that Natalie was standing when she received the first blows to her head. During the struggle, he unwittingly pocket-dialed his ex-wife, who heard the screams. Investigators were never able to prove precisely where the attack took place. With Natalie unconscious, Patrice took off her belt and tied her hands behind her back in case she came to. He placed her in the back of the Kangoo van and drove off. At this point, blood evidence in the back of the van indicated that Natalie was no longer alive. Patrice drove to the edge of Marley Forest, where he carried her into the woods and covered her body with branches and foliage. On his way back to the road, he threw the stick into the underbrush. It was a dark night, and he didn't realize that he had left the stick right next to a footpath. Gendarmes had no trouble finding it. Patrice took the cash from the Clos de Rose Natalie had with her to make her murder look like a robbery gone wrong. At 4 a.m., Patrice's phone pinged off a tower near a location where a speed camera took a photo of Natalie's van. He parked the van about a mile from the Clos de Rose and walked back, going straight to his room. It's unclear what happened in the deep dark hours of the night. The phone call to Sandrine occurred at 9 p.m. Patrice was back home just before 5 a.m. Natalie was no longer alive, and Patrice had her all to himself, driving around, looking for somewhere to leave her. Patrice Chevalier's defense attorney, Sophie Gallet, brought some doubt into the case and felt so strongly about her client's innocence that she insisted on an acquittal. The strongest point, arguably, was the fact that the tire tracks found in the woods near Natalie's body were not made by her Renault Kangoo. Patrice did not own a car and did not have ready access to another vehicle. She also pointed out that Patrice's shoes did not match the prints found at the scene in Marley Forest. Patrice spoke in his own defense. Like in his statement to police, he called Natalie a friend of his heart. He said that if it was not for Natalie who gave him a job and a place to stay, he would have been on the streets. But his demeanor didn't fit his heartfelt plea. Throughout the trial, his arrogance shone through. He rolled his eyes up to the sky, like he was the only reasonable person in a room full of idiots. He also claimed that he wasn't impoverished and desperate, despite his earlier claims that Natalie saved him from living on the street. Chevalier claimed that he was earning 800 euros a month, and his room at the hotel only cost 50. I had 800 euros of pocket money left after my odd jobs in the cafe. I know many families who would like to have as much. He challenged the prosecution, saying that if he was guilty of Natalie's murder, why would he have left so much evidence for police to find? He wasn't that stupid. His attitude, along with his TT Parisian accent, did not make him look very good. With so much evidence against him, how could there ever have been a doubt as to his guilt? The thing is, he is a very convincing liar, and proof, even DNA, is only supporting a theory. He had an uncanny ability to refute the evidence, for instance, the blood evidence. It was never mentioned where the blood was. He was confronted with a statement like, "We have found blood on your clothes belonging to Natalie. Do you care to explain how it got there?" Somehow, he knew it was on his sleeve, also which arm sleeve, and telling the story of her nosebleed. Also, the fact that he was the last person seen with Natalie, something he didn't try to hide, made police doubt his guilt. He didn't try to hide or avoid interrogation. In fact, he gave them his full cooperation. He was extremely manipulative. In the end, he was sentenced to 20 years in prison by the Yvelines Assize Court. The judge made it clear after Chevalier was convicted that there were no other suspects in the case, and that he had no doubt whatsoever that justice was served. Today, Patrice Chevalier is serving his time in prison in his hometown of Poissy. Mark has taken over management of the Clos de Rose, in memory of the woman who gave him a lifetime of joy and happiness. He hopes to keep her spirit alive in the place where she loved to make others feel like they belonged. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.